Groucho Marx once noted that outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. As for a book's best friend, the ranks are thinning. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. In publishing circles, the best friend a book can have is someone who will talk about it. A bookseller, for instance, as well as a member of the media. With newspapers giving up on book reviews, television and radio hosts have taken up the slack, much to the relief of publicists and authors. Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, joins me from New York with more on who book people count as their best friends. And Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Hey there, Chris.
Well, you know, we often see and have spoken about here on the program the way that TV, television, and other media are now competing with books for everyone's attention. But of course, other media are also a great way to promote books. And in Monday's issue of Publishers Weekly, you'll be looking at how that media landscape is changing. So tell us about that.
Yeah, that's, you know, this is a really fun little story. We reached out to a bunch of publicists to get a sense of which media outlets, especially in TV, really move the needle when it comes to books. And I think you'll probably not be surprised to learn that some of the usual suspects are high on the list. For example, 60 Minutes and NPR. One publicist called Terry Gross, the queen of radio when it comes to moving books. And another publicist told us NPR. But there were some surprises on the list too. Bill Maher's HBO show Real Time is apparently vastly underrated, and authors who appear on that show appear to benefit in sales. CNN's Fareed Zakaria also rated some responses. The morning shows, of course, also rate. There's, you know, CBS This Morning and Today, for example. And on the political side, the Rachel Maddow show and Bill O'Reilly can really push the needle too, though obviously they push the needle for very different types of books. But here's what drove this piece in Monday's issue of PW. The publishing industry is about to lose two very big boosters. One in Stephen Colbert and the Colbert Report, who will be taking over for David Letterman, and of course Jon Stewart, who is leaving his desk at The Daily Show. Now, these two hosts really did remarkable work for publishers. And what's remarkable is that they focused often on books on their shows and brought in authors that were not so much the big bestsellers, but were really this, you know, these great, smart books from a range of presses. They had debut authors on, debut fiction authors, which is incredibly rare on a lot of TV shows. And one publisher told us that, you know, every time that an author appeared on The Daily Show, they had to go back to press. So just to give you a sense of how much those shows really meant to authors and to publishers. Now, someone will, of course, be taking over for Jon Stewart. So perhaps, you know, the love for small press and mid-list authors will continue. And Colbert will still likely have authors on his late night show, but in that it's a big network show, probably will be more bestsellers. But, you know, suffice it to say, the book business is wondering what's going to come next after these two shows that did such amazing work for them go away. As one executive noted, The Daily Show and Colbert were two shows that really appreciated authors for being authors and not for being celebrities. And I think that's very well said.
Well, indeed it is. And, you know, I'm very hopeful that we'll see someone take the places of Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart and continue to do that. After all, the book business is a great supply of content for those kinds of shows, and they need content on a daily basis. But speaking of television, maybe we should pitch a reality show on the Apple ebook case. That idea. And I don't know what we'd call it, but it'd be a great little thing, kind of the two of us hanging around courtrooms and discussing the latest twists and turn in that case. And this week, a twist and turn has come up in that a Wall Street Journal report put Apple back in the news just ahead of another appeal in the ebook case. And what's going on there?
Yeah, so you can count me in on the reality show. I feel like, you know, we've been doing our own little serial-like podcast following the ups and downs of this case in recent years. And of course, that's quite quieted down somewhat as Apple argued its main appeal, its appeal of Judge Coates' verdict in December of last year. But in early March of this year, I believe on March 10th, I'll be back at the Second Circuit as Apple argues that Judge Coates' remedy in the case, specifically the appointment of its compliance monitor, Michael Bromwich, is unconstitutional, or at the very least, that the monitor's conduct is, you know, not very nice. So, you know, this week, for the second time since Bromwich was appointed, appointed, as you mentioned, the Wall Street Journal has published kind of what I would call a hit piece on him, and by extension on Judge Coates and the entire antitrust case that was brought against Apple. So yeah, back in the news.
So I guess what you're telling me is the Journal piece isn't just objective journalism at its finest.
Well, the term consider the source does leap to mind here. And, you know, I mean that in two ways. You know, first, the Wall Street Journal reports on Michael Bromwich, the monitor in this case, appears in the journal's editorial pages, and it's labeled an editorial, so it's not a reported piece. And, you know, I think second, it's worth noting that the journal is owned by Rupert Murdoch, who, of course, is the owner of HarperCollins as well. And that HarperCollins is one of Apple's alleged co-conspirators, though they settled the charges against them and have never admitted any guilt. I think it's instructive for readers, though, to, if they read the Wall Street Journal article on Michael Bromwich, to just scroll down and read the comments. I think that's always kind of instructive, really. But those comments are just filled with this kind of anti-government, anti-Obama, anti-Eric Holder DOJ vitriol. And I think it's important to note that, because I think it shows, you know, how little the journal really reports the actual facts of this case, and how little the readers of the Wall Street Journal editorial pages really know about the case. Because, you know, and here's the thing. The case against Apple originated in the States. And if you look at the documents in the case, the first name, indeed the lead plaintiff and one of the case's biggest boosters, is Texas Governor Greg Abbott. So, you know, one has to explain to me how a severely conservative Texas governor like Greg Abbott gets a pass for pursuing the Apple eBook case and litigating this case right alongside the DOJ, while, you know, Eric Holder and Barack Obama are being held up as emblematic of this sort of anti-corporate federal overreach.
You know, well, Andrew, I love the comments in newspaper websites as well, but they never have very much to do with the facts of a story, no matter what the story is. And anyway, I suppose, why let facts get in the way of a good narrative, right? Is there a legal case here for Apple?
Well, I think there's less a legal case than there is a legal strategy for Apple. And, you know, because I'm part of this reality show we're doing on Apple now, I'm going to go ahead and greenlight that. I've gone ahead and read all these documents about Michael Bromwich, and I went back and looked at a lot of things that I hadn't looked at before. And I'll have a full report on what that legal case really is before the March 10th date. So you can look for that on the PW website. But in a nutshell, Apple is arguing that Michael Bromwich, their compliance monitor, is pretty much too nosy. You know, he's asking for too much stuff, too many documents, and too much time for Apple executives in carrying out his task. And his task is pretty narrow. It's to evaluate Apple's antitrust training and to create a new antitrust training program for Apple. And Apple's arguing that he's biased against Apple because he filed a declaration with the court against them. But it's worth noting that that declaration was filed after Apple filed a declaration against his conduct. So, you know, they're also saying he has a conflict of interest because he's billing Apple at a really high rate. So, you know, if he's getting $1,100 an hour, which I think is the rate that's been quoted, of course he's going to throw his shoulder onto this and rack up a lot of hours because he was getting paid handsomely for it. Now, none of these issues with Bromwich are new. Just over a year ago, you'll recall, we were talking about this very issue, and Apple had made these same claims, and the Second Circuit denied their request to stay the work of the monitor. But Apple is now doubling down on those claims, and I'll share just a few insights as to what I found in reading through the documents. I think probably overall, Apple is unlikely to prevail. In reading the complaint, it appears that, yeah, Michael Bromwich is being pretty aggressive in his duties, but, you know, isn't that what you would expect? And isn't that what you get when you lose an antitrust trial and you remain pretty highly defiant of the process that under which you are found liable? You know, I've read the monitor's last report to Judge Coates. It's 165 pages. It's interesting, but it's very long. And oddly, he praises Apple for their progress and says that, you know, their relationship is getting better. Apparently not. And, you know, the journal also has now twice raised the issue that Judge Coates and Michael Bromwich have a cozy relationship, that they're friends, and that apparently they own a condo together or something. And I've been unable to track that down and verify that, and no other news outlet is reporting that. So I think clearly this was probably fed to the Wall Street Journal editorial page to create a little bad press, interesting press, whatever you want to call it. But nowhere in the legal filings does Apple allege any type of bias or misconduct on Judge Coates' part. So that strikes me as more of a PR hit job than a legal case, and I don't think it'll be a factor in the legal case before the Second Circuit. Now, getting down to Bromwich's bills, in order for Apple to prevail there, they need to show that irreparable harm has taken place. You know, thus far, Bromwich has billed Apple about $2.6 million to be the monitor for them. And Apple is on the hook to pay that. The government is not paying that under the order that Judge Coates signed. That's Apple's responsibility. And Apple says that figure could rise to as much as $7 million by the time this very aggressive monitor is done with his work. But I'm sorry, how does Apple, which made $18 billion in profit in the first quarter and is sitting on $180 billion in cash reserves, show that $7 million, if that's the final figure, $7 million in fees stemming from a legal case that it lost causes them irreparable harm? You know, I think that's kind of a moonshot for Apple. Now, is Bromwich getting fat off Apple? Probably. Definitely, in fact, I would say. You know, Apple claims that government-appointed monitors usually get to bill around $200 to $300 an hour for their work, not the $1,100 an hour that Bromwich is getting. But, you know, that $200 to $300 figure that Apple cites is when the government is paying the tab. And the government's a little more thrifty when it comes to spending its money than it is when it comes to spending Apple's money. But I'd look at it this way, too. If you've just won a major antitrust case against Apple, and Apple remains defiant and is continuing to file appeals and suits, and they have an army of $1,100 lawyers of its own and the ability to spend endlessly to frustrate you and all your aims, would you send a bargain basement $200 an hour lawyer in to do that job? I don't think so. You know, this is the big leagues when we're talking about antitrust compliance against a company like Apple. This is not the time for, you know, Better Call Saul. And I think the Second Circuit is not going to step in and rescue Apple from a $7 million legal bill, especially when it's a fate that, you know, it sort of earned for itself at trial. Now, that said, there is a very interesting constitutional question, which may be of interest to the Second Circuit in the appeal over Bromwich. But realistically, by the time the Second Circuit gets around to answering the constitutional question at heart here, Bromwich's two-year appointment is going to be very close to, if not completely up. So I think the real point of this battle is exactly that. They're trying to drag its feet. They're trying to run out the clock. They're trying to be able to frustrate the work of the monitor under the guise of a legal battle as much as they can. So I kind of view this case almost like, you know, like a soccer match. You know, if you've ever watched the English Premier League, you've probably seen, or the World Cup for that matter, you've probably seen when, you know, a soccer player barely gets touched, he goes down like he's been shot by a sniper in the stands, and he rides on the pitch for minutes. And this is an attempt to sort of run down the clock and, you know, get a little breather. And I think that's probably what's going on here. The more that Apple can delay, the less it will have to deal with the monitor's request. And as you would expect, I wouldn't expect Apple to roll out the red carpet in Cupertino for a monitor to come in and interview its executives and look at its books. So a lot of this is, I think, a legal strategy to just sort of frustrate the monitor and keep things from getting done.
Well, as always, terrific analysis and a soccer metaphor. Sounds like a man who's just come back from Europe.
That's right. I would have just got back from Barcelona, but unfortunately, I did not get to see the great Lionel Messi play while I was there. But you're right. It probably did affect my metaphors in this sense.
It'll be for another time then that you'll get to see him in action. Well, Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, as always, we thank you for joining us on Beyond the Book, and we'll see you on the set of our reality show.
My pleasure, as always.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, beyondthebook.com. Our engineer and co-producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.